The following audio program is suitable for all ages. It's July 9th, 2005, and you've tuned in to the RetroBits podcast. Hi, welcome to the show. My name is Earl Evans, and I'm your host. This is where we talk about computing like we did it back in the day. If it's got 8 bits, paper tape, punch card, CPM, BASIC and ROM, or if it's just plain old, then you found the right place. We're all about old school computing and modern day fun. More information on the show is available at our website, www.retrobits.com. You can get directly to our podcast at retrobits.libsyn, that's libsyn.com. And, of course, you can send us feedback at retrobits@gmail.com. How's everybody doing? It's good to be with you again. Got show number one in the bag, and that was a weight off my shoulders, get everything all figured out, and got a podcast published, and woohoo, we're out there. And we're up to show number two, so yay! Did the first show, had the guts to get behind the microphone again, and it's a good feeling. So, I wanted to take just a couple minutes in this podcast and introduce a little bit more about myself. Again, like I mentioned, my name is Earl Evans. What I do for a living is that I work in the information security field at a large U.S. corporation. I'm married and I have 2 kids. My son Joshua is 7, my daughter Jessica is 6. And our family lives in the Pacific Northwest area of the United States in Portland, Oregon. Just a few days ago, we had our 4th of July celebration. We had a bunch of fun. We did some fireworks just with our own family out on the street. And then for the 4th of July proper, we went to a local town show where they have some games and, you know, do some different things. And then when it gets dark, then they have a fireworks show. And it was a lot of fun. They do it at a local high school. And we've done that a few different years while we've been up here. And we always have a good time. My kids managed to talk me into doing the gunny sack race when it was the adult's turn. And next time I'll listen to that little voice in my head that says, pay attention when your kids say yes, but your body says no. I think my back is still hurting a little bit over that. But I got some other things going on. There's a new Transformers cartoon series on television. My son's really into that. We just watched a second episode of that on Cartoon Network today. He's really excited about that. And also, we've got some friends coming in from out of town tomorrow, and it'll be good to see them. My friend Tony and I used to sell 8-bit computers when we worked in computer retail way back when. And so I told him about the show and, you know, what we're doing here, and it's going to be good to be able to spend some time with him. You know, last week we covered a particular computer model, the Commodore VIC-20, in some detail. And it occurred to me after I did the show that we've never really talked about what retro computing or vintage computing actually means. What does it mean to people? Kind of take a look at it from a higher level. And so I thought I would take this show number two and talk about the general concept of retro computing. Now, people call it a number of different things. I've heard it called, I've heard the machines called retro computers, vintage computers. Some folks call them classic computers, and actually others just were more blunt and called them old computers. And what does old really mean? Well, you know, your definition's going to vary depending on what type of computers you're interested in and what sort of things are fun for you, but a rule of thumb that I've heard applied is that retro computing is about anything that's older than about 10 years old. And that's kind of the rule that I've used. And a lot of the computers, it turns out, that I'm interested in were from back in the late 70s and early 80s, so it's easy to meet that criteria. But, you know, about 10 years, sometimes it can be, you know, 20 or 30 years old. And it doesn't matter, just I guess what we're really looking at is something that's not necessarily for mainstream use today, something that the value is primarily revolving around a hobbyist interest. It's a hobby. It's, you know, personal enjoyment is the deal. Now, part of what I wanted to cover in the show today is why people are interested in retrocomputing. I think I mentioned in the last show that there's been a resurgence of interest in these older computers, that retrocomputing has taken off. I mean, I see more resources on the internet, more conversations going on about retrocomputing all the time. Why I'm personally interested, why did I decide to do this podcast? Why have I been collecting old computers and playing with them? I thought I'd take a couple minutes and just cover that. One thing is that these old computers were a big part of my life while I was growing up. When I was in high school and in my early adulthood, the computers took up a large portion of my discretionary time. And I also worked in computer retail, so they were my vocation as well as my avocation as well. So it's just kind of fun. It's kind of fun to drag these things out and play with them and learn more about them. The really interesting thing is that I've learned a lot more about the computers lately than I knew back when they were brand new. Part of that is because of the internet, and you've got these resources for information and collaboration that you didn't have before. And, you know, I really like the old 8-bit microcomputers. Just for me in general, they're just fun. They're very fun to play with. Now, that's not to say that I don't like the new stuff. I do. I work in the computing field, and I spend an awful lot of my personal time in computing as well, and some of it with modern technologies like .NET or Linux, that kind of stuff. But also when I was thinking about it, it occurred to me that people who restore old vehicles, like vintage cars, people who restore clocks or different other objects. There's people who are into restoring paintings or old architecture, that kind of thing. And by way of collecting, people collect all kinds of things that are old for both personal interest and historical value. Folks collect coins, stamps. Sometimes these things have a particular rarity and value that go along with them. For instance, I saw an Apple I, the predecessor to the Apple II, one time on eBay, and it went for a pretty penny, if I remember correctly. Although I don't tend to collect things that are valuable for the sake of any kind of economic value or investment. I'm just, like I say, I'm doing it for fun. A contrast, you know, old computers are completely for fun, because unless you're in an extremely niche field, it's very unlikely that you're using old computers to make money. And that's definitely true in my case. I don't make any money. I've spent quite a bit of money, but today's computers, I find, are mostly for using. They can be fun too, but they're usually not fun specifically for the technology per se. Today's computers are fun because of all the extraordinary things they can do, like extreme multimedia, gaming, listening to music, watching videos, that kind of thing. The old computers are fun because they were just fun to tinker around with, and fun just for the technology. Now, I've tried to observe, as I've participated in and read internet forums and news groups and that kind of thing, figuring out what is it that draws people into vintage computing just in general. Why is it that people like this? And I've put together some reasons that occurred to me. And, you know, I want to make it clear. I've been in this for a few years and I've kind of looked around, but there's a lot of things that are going on in the vintage computer community that I haven't necessarily been a part of. I've never gone, for instance, to one of the festivals, one of the festival style shows or trade type shows that they have for vintage computing. I'm hoping this coming November to make it to the Vintage Computer Festival. They're up to Vintage Computer Festival 8.0 in the Bay Area in California. And I really want to save up and go to that show, but there's a lot of things that I haven't done. So a lot of what I'm going to cover tonight is just speculation. And if you're in the retro computing hobby and you think I left some stuff out, hey, send me an email. In fact, we're going to be covering a lot of things in the show, in this episode and upcoming episodes, where I'm going to be looking for feedback from the listeners. I want to make it an interactive experience if I can, and kind of get the knowledge of the community flowing here. But again, so with standard disclaimer, the following are my observations. One of the reasons that people like these vintage computers is because of nostalgia. Like myself, they lived through the years where these computers actually came out and were popular. And just in general, it's fun to go back and see things that you've seen before. It's kind of like a rerun, I guess. And it's fun to see the screen light up and to remember the intrigue and the fun that you had back in those days. I think people like retro computers for a lot of the technical aspects. One thing is, these systems are just plain simpler than modern-day systems. Now, they may not be simpler from the user perspective, meaning that it's a lot more user-friendly to sit down in front of a modern-day computer like a Windows XP machine or a Macintosh and use the computer from a layman's point of view. But in terms of the guts of the computer, the microprocessor, the chipset, the technology around the computer, the old computers, you could really wrap your mind around them. I mean, I know in my Commodore days, I knew people who knew everything that there was to know about a VIC-20 or a Commodore 64 or an Atari 800 or an Apple II. There still are today. If you visit some of these news groups and web forums that are out there on retro computing, the most obscure technical question can get posed and is answered within a day or two by people who are just extremely knowledgeable. And I think part of it is these systems were so simple, you could just keep the whole thing in your head. And there's a lot of allure to that. There's a draw to that. The older computers, in some cases, were easier to experiment with. The circuit boards were not this super duper compressed, high miniaturization thing. I mean, you could actually pop the thing open, look at the circuit board and solder in your own switch for a reset switch or, tie into the computer with other electronic stuff that you built. And, in particular, the Commodore 64, the VIC-20, like I mentioned in last week's show, had that user port where people could tie in, and that became very popular. And there were similar hobbyist type things that happened across the other 8-bit computers. And I'll make a little dig here against modern day computers. And I realize that they're so much more sophisticated and they've got a lot more to do. But let's face it, folks. The old computers booted up faster. I mean, when I turn on my Commodore or my Apple or my Radio Shack TRS-80 Model 1, it's just like a half a second and pow, that thing is ready for business. Now, okay, you want to talk about loading a program from disk and running it and getting it to do something? Yes, that's slower. Sometimes. You know, sometimes I think that I was actually a lot faster in WordStar on a CPM system than I am in Microsoft Word. They're just, sometimes there's less lag. You know, as these computers these days have gotten more and more capable, we have figured out more and more taxing type of programs to throw at them. And so overall, your speed has not dramatically increased. And when you turned one of these old systems on, you know, bang, it was on. Another interesting thing about the older computers is the diversity of the systems. You know, today we've got a pretty homogeneous type of environment, for better or for worse, and in a lot of ways it's better. I will admit it's nice to have standards. But the environment today is pretty predictable. You're going to be sitting in front of a Windows system. You're going to be sitting in front of a Macintosh system. Now, people will extol the user-friendliness and the solid user interface construction of a Mac, and not having used one in a long time, especially not having used OS X, I can't speak to this personally, but I have heard from other folks that if you're familiar with a Windows box, it's not an extreme leap to jump over to a Macintosh and use the Macintosh or vice versa, because the graphical user interface concepts have become pretty homogenous. So is the hardware. I mean, there's a ton of different hardware choices, but in general, you're going to be dealing with some hardware standards. Whereas in the past, you had a lot of diversity. All of the 8-bit systems virtually were different than each other. In some cases, they ran a common operating system, a number of them based on, in particular, the 8080 and the Z80 chipset ran CPM. So at least you had a common operating system, but the hardware architecture for the machines varied significantly, and some had particular features that people like. I know that with the Atari computers, they had some pretty extremely good video capabilities with their video chipset. With the Commodore 64, you had a sound synthesizer chip, the SID chip, which was renowned for its ability to produce complex sounds with its attack, decay, sustained release sound synthesizer capability. So people will gravitate toward a particular older model just because, you know, it had some bells and whistles that they really dug. Also, one interesting thing that I've noticed is the enjoyment of a particular system doesn't and probably shouldn't end with that system's obsolescence. I mean, just because a computer is obsolete, quote unquote, doesn't mean that it's not fun for you to take out and play with and use. It may not be the state of the art for you to get your day-to-day things done, but it can still be an awful lot of fun to tinker around with. I know that's true for me. Anyway, so that's my little explanation there for why people like retro computing. Those are some of the things, and again, your mileage may vary, and if it does, retrobits@gmail.com. Let me know. Now, with respect to the ways that people enjoy retro computing, what are things that people do with these things? How do they participate? Well, one thing is learning. Like I mentioned, with the availability of the internet today, you've got information resources on your favorite old system that I guarantee you probably did not exist 5-10 years ago. A primary way of sharing information back in the day was either through users groups or BBSs, and it was not possible just based on space constraints and speed to archive the vast quantities of information that you're going to find on these vintage computers today. So people like to learn. I love to go out and read new things that I didn't know about my favorite computer companies or my favorite computers, and now I can do that, including lots of magazine archives that I've noticed that are starting to pop up online. Some of them have been around for a while. Others are just ramping up, but of course, unless you happen to be an extreme pack rat and saved all the magazines that you subscribe to, those things were in essence lost to us. But now they're back. They're back on the internet. It's a great thing. From a collecting perspective, having 14, 15 of these things, I can tell you that it's fun to collect them. It's fun to take them out and play around with them. I guess there are some people who just collect them for the sake of collecting, for the sake of being able to take them out and look at them like you might a coin or a stamp. But that's not me. My deal is I like to take them out and I like to poke around on them, and you know, no pun intended there, but for those of you familiar with the basic programming language, I was not making a pun, but I'm not above it. And you'll probably notice me do that from time to time because I do love puns. Now, there's a couple different ways that you can enjoy the old computers. One is to play with the real thing, and a lot of people have that preference. A lot of other people like old computer emulation. This is an extremely fortunate time if you're a fan of emulation. Now, what that is, like I talked about last time, there are programs that you run on a PC or a Macintosh or a Unix box, and these programs run on a contemporary computer, emulate or act like the old computers. In some cases, these emulators are like right on the money. I mean, purists will tell you that there's nothing like having the real thing for complete compatibility. And so that makes sense to me. But I got to tell you, these emulators are getting pretty close. And the advantage is that it doesn't take a whole closet and garage to store 14 or 15 different systems when you're dealing with emulation. You just need a few programs and you're off and running. In a lot of cases, these emulators attempt to be what they call cycle exact. They are attempting to be exactly like the microprocessor, base chipset, and et cetera, the computers that they're acting like. You can use these emulators to use the old software, including real-time games. People have put disk images up on the internet that you can download and then load into your favorite emulator. So the whole thing is virtual. The disk is virtual. The machine is virtual. The emulators support sound. They have joystick emulation. One other thing that's interesting, these things let me play with systems that I never could have played with before. And in some cases, systems that I never will collect. I do have a number of systems that are not Commodore, but mostly for me, Commodore systems comprise the bulk of my collection, and anything that I get on into the future will likely be Commodore because I just don't have room to collect a width and a breadth of these systems. So with emulators, I can see horizons. I can play with computers that otherwise I'd just never get a chance to. And also, they let you play with systems that you may have never had a chance to play with in real time. There are emulators for mini computers like DEC mini computers, and even emulators for mainframe style computers. And unless you were a mainframe system administrator or somebody worked in the data center, probably you haven't had a chance to work with a mainframe. And even if you did, you didn't have the opportunity to boot it up and bring it down and play with it to your heart's content. So emulators, cool stuff. People participate in retro computing also by discussion groups. Now, the news groups, Usenet groups, if you haven't heard about this, and also they're archived pretty much live on groups.google.com. So if you haven't heard of the news groups, that's a good web-based interface to the news groups that you can go out and use. There's all kinds of activity on the news groups with respect to old computers. Now, I do want to warn you, from monitoring these news groups over the course of a few years, I've noticed that sometimes there can be flame wars or arguments that erupt on these news groups. And in some cases, the language and the tone can be somewhat unsavory. So just be careful on that if you're sensitive to those kind of things. There's a huge amount of great conversation that goes on these news groups and wonderful technical information. There's also web forums. Those have not taken off from what I've seen. Again, standard disclaimer, just as from my own perspective, the web forums have not kicked in quite the same way that the news groups have. And in either case, obviously, let the buyer beware in terms of what content you may happen to find out there. Wherever you let people congregate and start talking, you never know what you're going to bump into. People enjoy retro computers also for gaming. That's just a form of usage, but I think it's a category that deserves some discussion all by itself. The old computers focused a huge amount on gaming. They existed at the same time as the older game console machines in similar fashion to the way that a Windows or Macintosh computer or a Linux system is existing in the same time frame as something like an Xbox. So you've got kind of a trade-off there. A general-purpose computer can do more things, whereas a console computer is guaranteed to play that game extremely well. I will say, that in the old days, you didn't tend to have as much trouble with game compatibility as maybe you do now. And part of the reason is if you wrote a game for a Commodore 64 or an Atari 800, it would run on pretty much all Commodore 64s or all Atari 800s worldwide. The hardware didn't differ to any great extent. With some computers, it might differ how much RAM you had and that kind of thing, but when you were running on that system, you knew you had the whole system to yourself, and you could predict exactly what kind of hardware you were dealing with. So compatibility issues were dramatically reduced, and gaming was incredible. I mean, there are thousands of titles out there for these systems, and people still play those thousands of games today. People like to program the old computers. Like I shared with you last time talking about the VIC-20, it's amazing, you know, that little computer, that little modest computer, and you've still got people programming it today and still actually writing tools that make it easier to program it. One of the interesting things about the programming tools that are out there today is they leveraged the strength of modern systems. That is, you use your PC or your Mac or your Linux box to do your programming. You produce the executable code, and then you move that code over to the older system and run it. So you've got the best of both worlds. You're doing your software development on a highly capable machine, and then you're running your software, your end work, on that older box. Yeah, it's sweet. Programming these old systems is challenging, too, because they are constrained by memory and by speed and by the number of characters they can display and by their input-output and all kinds of things. So if you want to try and accomplish something, it's an interesting challenge to see if you can accomplish it on the older systems. And people are doing that. I mean, I've seen one thing in particular, an operating system environment called Contiki, C-O-N-T-I-K-I. I'll try and have a link for that in the show notes, and you can Google it as well. I've seen it out there for the Apple II and the Commodore 64, and I know it's being ported to other systems. It's a OS that is advertised to run for memory-constrained systems, but it's a multitasking operating system with TCP/IP built into it, a web browser. I mean, can you believe this? This is just something. Now, in terms of enjoying these older computers, there are some challenges. There's some challenges that the retro computing industry is facing. I mean, we're going to have to get together on this and, you know, try and figure out how we step up to these things. Like, one, a lot of the old software is lost. And, you know, I'm just afraid that some of it's lost forever because it never got put in some sort of a form where it could be easily archived. The disks have all hit the landfill or the cartridges, and it's gone. And that's a shame. And other software, while it's obsolete and no longer sold, can sometimes be subject to copyright, so you can't really put that software out there. I know people do, and there's a concept of abandonware, and that's a very controversial concept in the industry. Some people say that these copyrights should be loosened so that this old software doesn't get lost forever through lack of interest. And other people say, well, you know, this is intellectual property. We got to protect it. And so it's an interesting controversy that rages on there. Another challenge is that connecting between the older systems and modern computers can sometimes be tough to figure out. Now, in an upcoming show, we're going to talk about how you can connect up an Apple. We're going to talk about how you can connect up a Commodore. I know you can do at least those two because I've done it personally. And also, I'll be looking for information on how to connect up other systems. I know that there's also a way I've seen, but, you know, don't push me for technical details because I don't know them, but I know that there's a way to do this with Atari systems as well, and probably with all the older systems. There's some way to hook them up. I mean, one clever thing I saw even was being able to hook up your Radio Shack MC-10 microcolor computer to your sound card and make the sound card emulate the old cassette player. So, I mean, there's clever ways to do this. We'll talk about some of those. But it can be rough when you're first getting into this, trying to figure out, how do I make my old computer talk to my new computer? So we'll get there. And, you know, finally, these are computers. They're devices. They're physical devices. And eventually, they're just going to poop out. They're going to fail. When they do, luckily enough of a lot of these computers were made so that you can get some spare parts, and there's a lot of helpful people out there that'll help you repair it. You know, that can only last so long though. I mean, I can foresee a day in the next generation where these systems are just plain gone. And emulation is one of the things that is going to save the technology of these systems from complete annihilation as time does its naughty destructive work. Media also fails over time. Floppy disks, that kind of thing. So, you know, got to figure out some way to get this stuff archived in a fashion that's going to stand the test of time. Final thing that I'll look at on this is, where is retro computing going? Well, I don't know. I mean, it's just getting more and more popular. Emulation is getting better and better. I know that people are interested in it because even in the commercial marketplace, you're beginning to see some replicas of older systems, particularly game systems, being packaged and sold. One, for instance, I think it's called the Atari Flashback. And in another case with the Commodore, there's something that's called the DTV. I'm going to look up some more information on this. And all of these things are tiny, like they fit in the form factor of an old joystick, but they're a complete replica of the old computer, including a whole bunch of games and a lot of fun for people. And the fact that those things exist tells me that there is a draw for these old technologies. Another interesting project, hope to get some more information for you and possibly even do a show on this particular item called a C1. If I remember right, it's called the reconfigurable computer. It's a motherboard that will fit in the same form factor as a modern ATX style. And it can be made to, in hardware, not just software, it can emulate older systems like a Commodore 64. And you can actually fiddle with the hardware itself. The hardware is programmable. Interesting stuff. I believe that programming will still continue to happen, and this concept of leveraging the power of modern systems to create programs for these older systems is just going to get better as time goes on. Now, collecting prices a few years ago started to go way up with the advent of collecting these computers on eBay and that kind of thing. There was some almost a speculative price run-up for a while. Now, that's tapered off a bit, or at least that's what I've heard. And you can get reasonable prices on auctions for these older computers and possibly, you know, check for sale boards. People find them at garage sales. It's a lot of different places to find the old systems. Gaming will, of course, that'll just be popular forever. So where that's going, people are just going to continue to play the games old and new. And as you stay tuned to our show, I'll continue to always try and keep my finger on the pulse of this and tell you what some of the new exciting things are that are happening. So that's my little spiel on retro computing, just trying to, you know, put us all on the same page here and talk about what retro computing is all about and partly explain the motivation for having this podcast and, you know, why we're here doing this. Now, by way of news, so I'm switching gears here. I'm going to talk about just a couple of news items, things that I've found over the past week that were interesting to me that I found out on the web forums and news groups. One thing that I found in the Commodore news group, there's a project underway to create a circuit card and some components that will allow you to take a compact flash card, plug it into the disk drive port of a Commodore computer, and use that compact flash card as a Commodore disk drive. One of the pictures that I saw on the internet of this had a 1 gigabyte compact flash card in there. So if you could just imagine, I mean, that would store a significant percentage of all the software that was ever invented for the Commodore 8-bit computers. That was interesting. By way of connectivity, I saw a post on the Apple Usenet group regarding the compatibility of an Apple II Ethernet card called an Uther card, U-T-H-E-R. Now, it looked like when I went to the website for this card that they had a limited run and the card is all sold out. So it'd be a bummer if you wanted to buy one, but they said if you did want one in the future to send them some email, they'd put you on a list. But this card apparently is compatible with that OS that I talked about, Contiki. So with Contiki and an Ethernet card and your Apple II, wow, you're just right uptown. You're out there surfing the web, I guess, and sounded like it worked with either hard coding the IP address or working with DHCP. So, woohoo! Now, also one of the things on the Apple II news group I noticed is that they've got an incredible set of frequently asked questions or FAQs on that comp.sys.apple2. That's the number two Usenet group. And I've looked at those FAQs before, and the amount of information in there is just fantastic. So if you're an Apple II fan, you're looking for information on the Apple II, be sure to check out those FAQs. Now, last week I talked about a form of the ASCII character set that the Commodore computers had called PETSCII. It was ASCII, but extended with special graphical characters that were unique to the Commodore. Apparently, I found out Atari's got the same thing. They have something that they call AT-ASCII, A-T-A-S-C-I-I. Same sort of deal. The Atari computers, but expanded with graphic characters, etc. So it's an extension of the ASCII character set. Now here's another kick. If you were around back in the day, you remember BBSs. Well, BBSs have taken on a new life over the Internet. You can use the Telnet program, which is an interactive terminal program on the Internet, and Telnet to some BBS software now that's connected to the Internet. So you don't need to pay high long-distance charges. Just get out there with your Internet connection and connect up to one of these BBSs, and you'll be like right back where you were. One in particular that I noticed out there, now I know there's tons, but this is just the one that I happened to notice today, was called the Electric Cafe. And if you telneted to thecafe.dtdns.net on port 8888, you'll go to that BBS. And I actually went out there and I connected and I registered and, boy, it was fun. I was out on a BBS again. Now, one of the things that I'm going to do over the next few weeks is broaden my horizons. I'm familiar with certainly just a subset of the old computers that are out there, but there are news groups and web forums and activities for all sorts of things. So I'm going to broaden myself up and get out there and look for whatever I can find on a wide swath of these computers. If you have particular resources that you want to recommend to me, again, send me some feedback at retrobits@gmail.com and I'll make sure to take a look. Well, that's all I've got for today. I was going to do a little mini retrospective on one of the Radio Shack computers, but I'm noticing by looking at the clock that I'm already a bit over. Again, I try and keep the show to 30 minutes, and I'm running a little bit lower this time than I did last time. So, you know, eventually I'm going to sneak up on my goal here, or, hey, maybe I'll just have to broaden it to a 45-minute show. Who knows? Time will tell. But anyway, that's it for this episode. Again, if you want to send us feedback, it's retrobits@gmail.com. Be sure to visit our website at www.retrobits.com. And you can actually find where our podcast is hosted, including the RSS feed. You can find a link to that at www.retrobits.com. But if you want to go direct, it's retrobits, R-E-T-R-O-B-I-T-S, .libsyn.com. Hey, you know, thanks for tuning in again. We got show number two done, and I'm feeling pretty pumped here. Feeling like this is going to be a fun experience, and I hope you feel the same. Let me know the good, bad, and the ugly, retrobits@gmail.com, and I'll see you next week. Take care. I'm rebooting for now.